First case then, House Number 1322588CR, Pedro Castillo versus the State of Texas.
Your Honor, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. It is with great honor to appear before you and a privilege to appear on behalf of the appellant Pedro Oscar Castillo. The Fifth Amendment guarantees due process of law when someone's life, liberty, or property is at stake. And there are few situations where there is more important than in criminal trials. Texas and federal courts have long held that the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause protects a defendant in a criminal case against conviction except upon proof beyond a reasonable doubt of every fact necessary to constitute the crime with which he is charged. Before I address the issues of sufficiency of the evidence for conviction, the lack of an election by the state in the jury charge, and bolstering by assigners, I would like to make a preliminary comment on the question of context on what constitutes the consideration of this request. The Texas legislature, following a national trend and following Jessica's law in Florida, created the offense of continuous sexual abuse of a minor, arguably the second most serious offense in the state of Texas. Beyond imposing a harsh punishment, punishable harsher than 99% of all felonies in the state, the continuous sexual abuse of a child statute is particularly disturbing and could have dire consequences when the jury is tied to a minimum of 25 years to life for any conviction. As to the sufficiency of the evidence, the statute provides that a person commits the continuous sexual abuse of a child if during a period that is 30 days or more in duration, the person commits two or more acts of sexual abuse, regardless of whether the acts of sexual abuse are committed against one or more victims. And at the time of the commission of each act of sexual abuse, the actor is 17 years of age or older, and the victim is a child younger than 14 years of age. Although the legislature intended the statute to be flexible when it came to the different allegations as a continuous, it has stated that it is one of the most inflexible aspects is the time element, which requires that during a period that is 30 days or more in duration, the person actually commits two or more of the acts of sexual abuse, regardless of whether the acts of sexual abuse are committed against one or more victims. The other element that the legislature and the courts have ruled that is very inflexible is that the child has to be under the age of 14. Appellant is charged from the specific dates of September 1st, 2009 through January 1st of 2016. It's important to note that the complaining witness was born on June 8th, 2001, meaning the tail end of the alleged dates go beyond the age of 14, which creates confusion and allow the jury to possibly guess events occurred outside of the scope of the indictment. As we go
through the
facts.
So you're saying there should have been separate charges for events after the age of 14? Or what do you?
Yes, Your Honor, there are, and I missed the question, I'm sorry, but I assume that the question was that in count two, yes, ma'am, there is a, count two goes after, and unfortunately count two goes after the age of 14, but it's a one count of indecency with a child. And the problem that that creates combined with the first count is that traditionally in these cases of continuous sexual assault, what ends up happening is there's usually a variance between the indictment and what you actually hear at trial because of the way these trials proceed, where you usually have the prosecutor asking, well, can you tell us of another instance? And can you remember another instance? And can you tell us what happened next? So many times what you see on the indictment, as in this case, you have three actual allegations in the acts of sexual abuse or the laundry list. But then when you get to actual trial, you hear many other extraneous events. And those extraneous events, when you combine them, well, the prosecution's, when they charge this to the court, they say, well, as long as the jury finds that two or more of these occurred in a period of 30 days or more, creating confusion. Unfortunately, the courts have held that they just have to be unanimous as to the 30 days or more or two or more acts. But the way that they are phrased, it creates this whole set of extraneous offenses, which then can be lumped in together. And that's what could have happened in count two of this case, where in count two, you have all these extraneous offenses, and they said, well, something must have happened after July 1st, 2016.
Okay, and so one of your complaints that you're going to talk about is this failure to for the court to have the state elect. And I'm a little confused by your argument because you are aware that under continuous sexual abuse, an election is not required. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay, so then your complaint as to their failure to elect is as to just count two?
As to count two, Your Honor. But the thing is, with count two, it lumps into count one because it creates that confusion for the jury. So even if the jury charge would have been correct where they have to elect, it would have forced the state to say, well, okay, what periods after 2016? As to count one, I still have, there's still an issue with the sufficiency because 2015 and 2016 would put the complaining witness over the age of 14. And because there was never any dates stated or elicited from the complaining witness, it just said it happened when I was in this home, it happened when I was at that home, it happened when I was at a young age.
But isn't that sufficient though, that they're able to, I mean, I think it's very common for the children, you know, are not gonna remember dates. I don't remember dates, but yet they can associate an event with certain, you know, times in their life, such as in this case where the family was living at the time. Why isn't that sufficient to put it in context of a date?
Yes, and the legislature, anticipating how difficult it is for children to remember these dates, made it very flexible for the state to argue, well, as long as it happened in this time period or we can remember that time period. But nonetheless, you still need to be able to quantify 30 days or more. And if you have no starting point, well, how can you have a counting of 30 days or more? And the issue here is that there's never any date of when this actually allegedly begins. They just state 2009 to 2016, and 2009, if I'm not mistaken, is when the statute comes in effect. So anything prior to 2009, which could have been in the case here, I mean, shouldn't come in. And it's outside of the scope of the indictment. Such as, for example, the same nurse medical report. On that one, the same nurse medical history, the child says that this happened when she was six. So that would have been prior to 2009, which is outside the scope of the indictment. And also, understanding that is why the courts have said, well, we have to be very inflexible with the 30 days or more, or the two or more acts within the time of the indictment. The other issue I still go back is after 2014, the child would have been over the age of 14. So the jury would have been confused as to what exactly, if any of these events happened in 2015 or 2016, because there was never any factual dates elicited from the complaining witness.
But there was testimony of some sort that this kind of this happened in those dates where it was applicable, where it's undisputed she was under 14. There is testimony on the record, is that correct?
The only that is correct, Your Honor. The only testimony that we have is when she's interviewed by one of the detectives in this case. She claims that some of these events happened when he was a jailer, and that's what is elicited to the jailer. And when the investigator testifies, he says, "Look, she could never give me any dates. I had a concern with that. But what I did is I went back and looked at his records and figured out that he had been a jailer this time frame, which was about a year and a half." But when she testifies, she can't give any dates. And when the judge, Judge Uresti, actually questions her, well, did you ever tell the investigator that? She does admit that she spoke to the investigator, but she can't remember any of the dates that she gave the investigator. So they extrapolate those dates into their argument that there was some testimony that this occurred when she would have been 10 or 11. But nonetheless, it goes back to the issue of, well, what is the starting point and what is the end point? Because it has to be in 30 days or more. So if it happened within, assuming arguendo, that it happened all within 20 days when he was a jailer, well, it wouldn't meet the criteria of the statute, which is the 30 days or more requirement.
Regarding the preservation of error issue, did you preserve error on this election question?
I don't believe that it was the best preservation of error I could have done. I believe that the way I phrased the unanimity issue, it kind of confused it. And it wasn't until I went back and started writing the brief that I noticed that, well, one, because it is a constitutional issue and it's an issue with the jury charge, I can bring it up on appeal. But the Honorable Court is correct in that I don't think I did the best of work preserving that error, because it wasn't really until we get this jury charge and we get closing arguments that we don't really understand what charges or what events the court was going to use or the state was going to use for conviction.
But in your motion that you did file with the trial court, you are asking for a special instruction only. You don't mention anything about this election of acts.
Yes, Your Honor.
You don't raise it until your reply brief. So
yes.
It's a serious question there.
And the issue has been, Your Honor, that what is the court, what do the jurors have to be unanimous to, right? And the courts have spoken that they don't have to be unanimous as to the laundry list or the two or more events, but they do have to be unanimous that it happened in a span of 30 days or more, and they do have to be unanimous that it happened in two or more occasions within those 30 days or more. So I think I could have done a better job preserving that argument, but really I'm asking for unanimity as to the 30 days or more, or the two or more events. And as to count two, I am soliciting that they should have requested, or they should have elected, because count two is a single count of indecency. So on count two.
But was there evidence to, alleged by the state that more than one act supported that count?
Yes, Your Honor. And the problem is that when these cases go to trial, everything was just lumped in together and you'd have a lot of different acts. So as to count two, the only actual date that we ever hear is an incident that happened in 2019, which was the last alleged violation of any sort of criminal law. Pedro Castillo, the appellant, wasn't charged with that 2019 offense, but you do hear it from the complaining witness. And that 2019 is, again, outside the scope of the indictment. So you do hear several extraneous events that occur prior to 2009 and after 2016. And then at the end, the jury just had to make a decision, well, did anything happen around 2016? And that was, I actually moved for a directed verdict on that count. And the judge was very concerned and asked the state, well, what does the state have to say about this? Because I don't believe I ever heard any testimony as to that count too. And so when the jury has to be unanimous, well, they have to be unanimous as to that single count on count two of indecency with a child.
Okay. And you do agree that if we were to recognize that you have preserved a jury charge error, you would have to show egregious harm.
Yes, Your Honor. And the way that these trials proceed, it is very prejudicial because there always seems to be a variance between the charging instrument and the actual testimony that's elicited in trial. And you get a lot of these, you get two or three allegations on the laundry list, but then you proceed to trial and you get the prosecution asking, well, can you tell us of another instance? Can you tell us of another instance? And all those, in my opinion, become extraneous offenses or extraneous acts that don't rely back to the indictment. But at the very end, the jury can just say, well, you know, I believe issue A, I believe allegation B. Juror number two could say, I believe allegation three and four. So they don't have to be unanimous as to that laundry list, but if there are more allegations than three listed on the indictment, like in this case, well then, what is the jury really being unanimous to, and what are they really focusing on, and what are they really looking at? And as to count two, that bleeds into count two, where you've heard 15 or 20 allegations, and you have one count of indecency, well, the state had to elect, or at least put on some evidence to say, well, as to count number two, we're using these specific events that were elicited in direct testimony or through other witnesses.
Okay, why is the same report not admissible under 8034?
So traditionally, the medical exception to hearsay, Your Honor, is utilized in cases where, for example, if I am in a car accident and they take me immediately to the hospital, well, it's a real-time report. But these reports are usually produced for litigation purposes, and they're part of the prosecution team. So the same nurse will only do a report if it's on advice from a police officer. So an investigator or a detective has to actually submit that report. And what ends up happening is that medical history portion is not really an actual medical history portion. It's a history of what the allegations are. And what ends up happening is it bolsters the credibility of the complaining witness, because even though it's not a full medical report like here, there's no mention of any ankle, broken ankles, or any other medical conditions. All they're talking about is the actual assault. And one of the questions that is asked of the same nurse is by the state, so based on the patient's history, do you expect to find any trauma? No, why is that? Based on her history, everything would be healed. So are the findings that you got from the examination, are they consistent with the history that DC gave regarding the sexual abuse? And she states yes, bolstering the credibility of the complaining witness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
I'd like to thank this honorable court for the opportunity and privilege to present oral argument here once again. I'll begin with appellant's point of error number one regarding the sufficiency of the evidence. Now, appellant argues that the evidence is insufficient to determine for the offense of continuous abuse of a young child, that the sexual acts, the predicate offenses for that offense are more 30 days or more apart, and that all of those predicate acts occurred while the victim was under the age of 14. Now, appellant neglects to, I guess, to mention the fact that circumstantial evidence is just as probative and as forceful as direct evidence. Now, a rational jury could have inferred that there is more than sufficient evidence to prove these predicate offenses. In part, for instance, on one of the offenses, the victim testified that one of the predicate offenses occurred as early as September of 2009, which while the victim herself did not tell us the date of the year, a different officer that testified actually proved to the jury that the defendant was a jailer at the time, putting the time of that offense at 2009. Now, and we consider that as one of the predicate offenses, we know for a fact that a different offense that was shown at trial happened between June of 2011 and June of 2012, based on where the mother and others testified that the family was living at the time. Now, that apart is obviously 2009 and either 2011 to 2012, that's obviously more than 30 days apart. And we know the victim was born in 2001, so we know 100% sure that she was under the age of 14 at the time. Now, there was also another incident, if in case that wasn't enough, that was shown that the victim was made to put her mouth on the appellant's penis between June 2012 and June 2013. So regarding legal sufficiency, yeah, it's correct that the victim never said, yes, he touched me or made me do this at this on this day, on this year. She never mentioned the years directly, but circumstantially, through other witnesses and other evidence shown, it's very clear that a rational jury could have inferred and did infer that these acts happened prior to the victim being age of 14, and they were for sure more than 30 days apart, because the evidence showed that several of the offenses were years apart, but all under the year 2014 regarding the continuous ones.
Yeah, right, so that's all true for the continuous sexual abuse, but what about for the second count?
Oh, yes, regarding the count two of indecency, it has to be that there's one where the victim and through other witnesses show that it happened from somewhere between 2013 and 2015. And so we know that there was evidence that she had to have been anywhere from 12 to 14, if not even 15. And so because that's the only evidence and of the only crime that happened at that late stage, so it has to be the evidence for count two.
There was evidence of only one.
Exactly, for that time period. Now, of course, there's a mention of something in 2019, but you know, she was already an adult of 17 or older at that point. She was born in 2001. So this offense that appellant brings up about 2019, that really has no bearing on that, because she was 17 or 18, possibly even 19, depending on what month and year we're looking at. But regarding
the state at the trial, did the state make it clear to the jury that they had to, you know, differentiate the act for count two versus the several other acts for the continuous sexual abuse?
Absolutely. Both in closing and opening and also throughout the testimony as well, you tried to basically differentiate between count one and count two, even though, of course, we know that some of the predicate offenses of count one, the continuous, also includes other counts of other indecency counts, and in count two itself is a separate indecency count. The key distinction being that by the years, the count two indecency is when she was 14 or older, whereas in the continuous one, it shows that based on the years, based on where they were living, based on where the defendant was employed at the time, it's necessarily so that she had to have been under 14 at the time because she was born in 2001. Otherwise, the years just don't add up. And that's why the jury felt that that was more than sufficient regarding point of error number one. Regarding point of error number two, appellant alleges that they asked the state and the judge to order the state to elect. Basically, all they have in the transcript and in the clerk's record, we have their motion for special requested instruction. And not only does the request not even include the word elect, or even a functional equivalent. In fact, as the court knows, and the court stated earlier, that the jury unanimity is not required as to which of the predicate offenses for continuous sexual abuse of a young child happened. The only thing that's required is the jury be unanimous that the predicate offenses happened 30 days or more apart, and that at the time for those predicate offenses that the victim was under the age of 14. And the jury does not have to be unanimous as to the dates themselves, as long as they comport with the 30 days or more and under age of 14. But apart from those constraints, there is no requirement that they be unanimous as to which ones. In the appellant's motion for special requested instruction, basically they asked the court literally and specifically to not instruct the jury that they do not have to be unanimous on the predicate offenses. In his motion, it says how the jury charge said, as basically copy and pasted from the penal code, where you don't have to be unanimous as to the predicate offenses, subject to those constraints that we talked about, and they wanted that deleted. It's very specific. He specifically says, the appellant says, they don't want that. He only wants it basically implying and directly, according to their motion, that they have to be unanimous as to the predicate offenses, which we know is not the law. And so that is what they're now construing as their election. Like I said, they never asked for them to elect. And in fact, in their motion and in the transcript regarding the relevant discussion, not once did appellant bring up election regarding the indecency at all. Not one time is that mentioned at all. The focus of that motion for special requested instruction was limited to the continuous sexual abuse of a young child. He never brought up the indecency. But even if he hadn't, of course, we know that the consequence of him not having to elect means that the appellant must show egregious harm. Now, I argue that he can't do that it's impossible to, because regarding count two on the indecency, there's only that one incident where she was 14 or older. So there's nothing to elect because there's only one incident of which she was 14 or older. So they say the judge were to have said, state elect. I'm like, well, judge, the answer is it's the only one we brought evidence of when she was 14. And it has to be that. It's one of one. So basically, in a sense, the appellant would be asking the state to say, choose which one out of one. And like, that wouldn't make any sense. So because of that, there's no way that they, in my opinion, that they could show egregious harm. And regarding the continuous, it would be contrary to the law if the judge had granted his motion for special requested instruction, because as we know, the law is not jury unanimity as to the specific constituent offenses for continuous. Regarding point of error number three, appellant claims that it was error to admit the sane nurse's report into evidence. Now, it's well known that had been held by both this court, all other courts of appeals, and the Court of Criminal Appeals, and it's routinely done so and admitted in these types of cases that the sane nurse report is admitted into evidence. It's very rare that one goes by and it's not admitted into evidence, both under Texas Rule of Evidence 803-4, and the Court of Criminal Appeals has also held that it's admissible under Taylor v. State, 268 Southwest 3rd, 571.
And you're specifically referring to the medical history portion, which is the concern here?
Correct.
They're not ever redacted or anything like that?
Correct. Under 803-4, of course, statements made for medical treatment or diagnosis are an exception to the hearsay rule. And it was under that rule and the business records affidavit, business record exemption, that evidence was brought. And furthermore, appellant mentions and complains in their brief that the state used it to basically bolster the victim and to try to basically say that she's telling the truth. However, in a careful review of the transcript reveals that it was actually appellant's counsel that he himself asked the same nurse on the stand on cross-examination, is the victim being truthful and telling the truth and being honest? So if anything, the appellant's counsel is the one that did that, not the state. The state didn't do that. The state never asked the sane nurse, is the victim telling the truth? But the appellant did. So regarding point of error number three, the state urges the court that it is not error to include the sane nurse's report. Timely filed business records affidavit was filed. A custodian of evidence, being the sane nurse herself, was there, present, gave the appropriate testimony and predicate questions for that record to be admissible. In fact, she herself was the one that created that business record as well. So regarding point of error number three, the state urges that there's no error there, that the law, the rules of evidence, and multiple appellate courts have held that's perfectly admissible. There's, even though it's construed as bolstering by appellant, that doesn't change the fact that the records are routinely admissible and have been upheld by this Court of Criminal Appeals, multiple other courts as well under that rule of law. Does the court have any further questions for me?
Do you have any questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate you giving us some time back.
May it please the court. As to point of error number three, which is the sane nurse, there have been other courts, especially out of the San Antonio Court of Appeals in Salinas v. State, 166, Southwestern 3rd, 368, at section 371, that when a sexual abuse examination has issue and there is no physical evidence of abuse, the testimony of the sexual assault examiner can only be seen as an attempt to directly bolster the credibility of the complainant and a direct comment on the complainant's truthfulness. In other words, if we knew, or the allegation is that this occurred many years ago, and they take this young lady to get a sane nurse examination, it's pretty obvious that there is going to be no trauma there.
Is that case cited in your brief? I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. It is cited in page 27 of the amended brief. And that case basically is saying that because these reports prepared for litigation, it's obvious that a lot of times that there is going to be no trauma noted. So the medical history portion is only there to corroborate. And usually the process how these happens or these cases come about is you have some sort of outcry. Then it's reported to the police. They do that initial report. Then you have a subsequent investigation, usually by a detective, who then takes the complaining witness to the sane nurse examination and to what's called the Child Advocacy Center. And both of these are recorded and put into one in the medical history and two as the MONIC or the Child Advocacy Center videos. And really that is used directly to bolster the credibility of this child, right? And to prove that she is consistent in her testimony. So here where the acts of alleged abuse happened many years ago, the only reason why they would bring this report is to really directly bolster what the girl was saying or the complaining witness is saying, because we know for a fact that there is going to be no show of any physical abuse. So really it's just designed for trial litigation and to bolster the credibility by saying, look, she also told the same nurse that this had happened. As to circumstantial evidence, there was a lot of circumstantial evidence as usually come about in these cases by the whole nature of the allegation themselves. And it is stated by a lot of different witnesses brought by the state, including the brother of the complaining witnesses, that they lived in many different apartments. And some of the dates that the state is eliciting, it is obvious from the testimony that they were living in San Marcos. So there's 2 years between 2007 and approximately 2008 when they're not even living in Cameron County. Once they come back in 2008, that is when the appellant starts living with his new spouse and they only live a couple of months, where this is where one of the supposed allegations happened. And after 6 months, they move back to his parents' house, and she moves back to her parents' house. So it's a little difficult to say, well, just because she's referring to these different places or these different locations, that something happened at the location. And I think that's the logical jump. But unfortunately, the way these cases proceed is that the state keeps asking, well, and what happened next? And can you tell us of another instance? So at the very end, the underlying issue, and that's why the issue of unanimity comes about, is that a lot of people start to believe where there's smoke, there's fire. And even though they haven't really found a particular element or a particular date, they're just hearing over and over that some sort of sexual abuse happened. And at the very end, I mean, juries will want to do the right thing, and they feel, well, if she's saying it over and over, there must be something. But once you look at it factually, you see that they had to piecemeal everything together. But once you look at actual dates, there's nothing to define the 30 days or more, or the two more acts within those 30 days or more, which is really the crux of the sufficiency of the evidence.
Thank you. The case will be under submission.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.